This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're going to start with the latest in our series of conversations with members of the Massachusetts congressional delegation. Today, it's the Massachusetts 5th, and we're joined in the studio now by Congresswoman Catherine Clark. Congresswoman Clark, it's so great to see you. Thank you so much for coming in.
Oh, it is such a pleasure to be here, Megan.
So there is a lot for us to discuss, as always. I just wanted to start off with a trip that you recently returned from. You were in Israel and Jordan, right? Where the delegation visit was focused on regional security and cooperation. So what kind of things did you hear there?
So we also were able to go to Afghanistan trip as well. And we were really focused on hearing what is happening right now. Where are we in the peace process? Where is the commitment to the two-state solution and to human rights?
And did you hear optimism there? Because I haven't heard optimism about that in a while.
There wasn't a lot of optimism coming out of these meetings, I regret to report. But I think it was important that we went. We met with the King of Jordan. We met with Prime Minister Netanyahu, Ambassador Friedman, and many people who are working and living in Israel, and lots of Palestinians as well. And the message that we delivered was Israel is our ally. It is a strong democracy in a very dangerous neighborhood, but we also want to see that commitment to a two-state solution, and that we believe that the security of Israel is best served by coming to a peaceful negotiation.
Okay, so and you, this was the message that you imparted to Prime Minister Netanyahu?
It was.
How did he respond to that? Because he sees, you know, in President Trump a strong ally, and it was after the election of President Trump that the idea of a two-state solution seemed to start withering away.
Yeah, and you know, we really talked to him about our commitment to it, how we can be helpful, how he sees the future of security in Israel. You know, the United States has been there. We're a strong supporter of Israel. He acknowledged that and was grateful for the support that has been given. But we were really saying to him, from very specifically around African asylum seekers issue that we raised with him, to more broadly on how we can move this peace process forward and become re-engaged again.
And then what did Prime Minister Netanyahu say to you in response to those things?
You know, I found that he is very focused on Iran and what is happening there. And it was hard to get him to talk about where he wanted to be with the peace process. And what we are trying to prevent is sort of having this new, the new status that we are currently seeing between Israel and the Palestinian Authority be the new peace. And that we have to really keep working and make sure that as the United States, we are pushing towards an actual two-state solution, which is harder to do under this administration. But I think we need to keep bringing that message that as a firm ally of Israel, we are watching and will continue to push for that.
Okay. So the Middle East being what it is, we could actually spend our entire time together about it. But there's a lot of other things to discuss. But before we leave the region entirely, I was just wondering what you think about President Trump's recent comments about possibly pulling U.S. troops out of Syria.
Yeah, we spent a lot of time on this trip asking people to reflect on lessons learned out of Iraq. Mm-hmm. And especially as we're, everybody wants a way to bring our troops home from Syria, from Iraq, from Afghanistan, where we visited. But how do we do that and ensure that we keep security in the region, that American interests are protected as well? And I think that is a balance. I'm glad to see that the president is sort of backed off a little and committed to a timeline after advice from his, those who are looking at Syria on the ground and saying, we don't want to pull out too hastily. So I hope that he will continue to evolve and look at what are the real security issues for the Syrian people, and that we don't pull out of there and perhaps tip the balance on what's a very precarious and dangerous situation.
So you were also in Afghanistan as well.
Yes.
Okay. So this, again, we're spending a lot of time on foreign policy, but these are big issues.
Yeah.
I mean, the United States has been in Afghanistan for, we're on year 16?
Yeah.
Now, 16 years. It's the longest continuous military engagement the United States has been involved in ever, practically. What did you see?
There was actually some room for optimism.
Okay.
As far as, you know, we met with President Ghani, the president of Afghanistan, and he is committed to a reconciliation process. He was very clear that his values are long-term peace means long-term security for the Afghan people. But we also have to know, how do we get the Taliban to the table? We're seeing some real violence emerging in Kabul and other parts of the country. And so we still have this balance of a commitment to the region, that people feel like there's still real progress being made. But also, how do we plan an exit? How do we determine and define what will be success for us that means our troops can come home?
Okay. So let's move on to another part of the world here. This is where foreign policy and economics comes together. And I'm talking about China, of course, and the trade war, skirmish. I don't know what you call it yet so far. But are you concerned about how Massachusetts could potentially be affected if indeed the sort of new posture between President Trump and China over trade gets even more intense? If we get into a trade war, let me just say.
Yeah, I am concerned. I think there was some reporting today on an industry we may not think of automatically, but the cranberry industry would be very much impacted here in the Commonwealth. Also in my district, we have lots of small manufacturing facilities that make parts for planes, parts for cars, parts for things that you might not say, oh, Massachusetts will be impacted if Boeing is, or if Detroit and the car manufacturers. But we are often in a long list of vendors that supply to those industries and will be negatively impacted. But I think mainly what concerns me is the way that the president does either foreign affairs, immigration, or now this trade war with China in an impulsive manner. And it's never clear to me, what is the end game? What is the strategy? How does, you know, putting out tariffs on steel, imposing tariff sanctions on Chinese goods, to what end?
Mm-hmm.
And where does the negotiating come in? And what is the long-term goal? And how does that actually get
right.
us towards it?
So I want to come back to this, to your big picture concern in just a second. But Massachusetts really is an interesting state to take a look at what the potential of a trade war could be. Because as you mentioned, right, the cranberry industry is concerned about Chinese tariffs on cranberries and small manufacturers that use steel, et cetera. But on the other hand, you know, the Trump administration is doing what it's doing because it wants to protect, you know, American intellectual property from theft from China, essentially. And that intellectual property is the bread and butter. It's the lifeblood. I'm mixing my metaphors now. But for so many businesses and industries in Massachusetts as well. And I just wonder what you think of that.
And I think it's a very valid concern, and one that certainly here in Massachusetts, where we have a real ecosystem of innovation, we want to protect that. And that is something that we have been talking about China and how they operate for a very long time. But it goes back to, there may be kernels of good things in all of these proposals, but when it's done over Twitter on a holiday weekend, it becomes hard to see what is the real strategy and how are these different steps taken by the president, often announced on social media, going going to get us there. And so while there are parts we all want better protections for intellectual property, I do think there are things that we need to negotiate with China over tariffs and our policies there. But it's disconcerting to see such an impulsive president move forward and then sort of be reined back in by his advisors and others in the White House and his cabinet.
So I'm hearing you say you don't like trade policy by tweet.
That's right. Okay. That's right.
But so, I you know, again, I take your point that there may be small things here and there which you like. But that set against your big picture concerns. But I am kind of curious about some of these details, right? Like, for example, the Trump administration is proposing, still a proposal, but a 25% tariff on a bunch of medical devices, for example, that would be imported from China. Now, this could ostensibly, again, it depends on what the devices are and what the, it depends on the final list of what the would be subject to the tariff. But I'm thinking it could potentially be helpful to medical device manufacturers in Massachusetts, right? You mentioned your district before, and I was looking up what Thermo Fisher, Boston Scientific. Right. These are two huge companies based in the Fifth.
Yeah. It's an incredibly dynamic and powerful industry in my district, in the Commonwealth, and potentially maybe that could help them. But again, I think that what we can't do is take a proposal that doesn't seem well thought out, isn't in looking at a broad trade policy, seems to take the president's own advisors by surprise. Certainly his Republican members of Congress were surprised,
right,
and say, you know, overall, I think this is a good idea or a bad idea. I don't think any of us really know. And I think that is the danger about sort of lurching from immigration to trade, to foreign policy, to Syria, without having put out what is the strategy? How are we trying to improve the lives of everyday Americans? And what will this mean for families?
Now, so, I mean, being a Democrat, you're in the minority party in the House here, but we've been focusing a lot on what you think the president should or shouldn't do. But he's allowed to impose these tariffs, right, because Congress has ceded that power to the president.
Right.
So I'm wondering, I mean, perhaps there's room here for even as a Democrat to advocate in Congress. Maybe Congress ought to pass a law and take that power back.
Well, I think there's a lot of areas where we have ceded great power. One of them, having just been in the Middle East, is the authorized use of military force. We are operating under an AUMF from 2001, and we have allowed not only the current president, but also President Obama to, you know, we haven't taken up that issue and made that hard vote that is our constitutional responsibility. So I think there are many areas where Congress has actually given great powers to the executive branch, perhaps at the peril of the American people and what our strategy is going to be. And I think we have to look at that and not be afraid to have these discussions and take some of that power back where we are directly accountable to the voters every 2 years in the House.
Yeah, so I'm just looking at some of the laws passed in previous decades by Congress that have allowed the president, and not just this president, but we saw the same thing with President George W. Bush, for example. There's the Trade Act of 1974, the International Emergency Economic Powers Act of 1977, the Trade Expansion Act of 1962. I mean, my point is that several times, there have been several times to what you were saying where Congress has said, okay, let's pass a law that gives the president these additional powers. Would you be willing, Congresswoman Clark, to, again, I get it, you're in the minority party, but still, like, sponsor a bill that says maybe we ought to take some of that power back?
You know, I think that I'm certainly open to looking at that, but I think that what we really need at this particular point in time, that is the state of our law, is for the president to set out a plan And, you know, what you don't want is to feel that our foreign policy, our immigration policy is being set by Fox and Friends and is sort of an impulsive reaction to what the president may or may not have seen on cable TV. We want to know that there is a strategy, that there is a vision, that he has a an idea of where he wants to go, and then we can react as we did, you know, with President Obama as he looked at what to do in Asia with trade and fast track and came to Congress for different votes around that. So it's not so much changing the authority always that we've given the president, but really let's have some more confidence. This is part of a comprehensive strategy. What are those goals and how does that fit into it?
So Congresswoman Clark, if you don't mind me saying, I appreciate what you're saying about needing more consistency from the president of the United States. But on the other hand, correct me if I'm wrong, but somehow my ears are hearing what you're saying, and part of me is thinking, well, the Congress is a co-equal branch of government with the executive. So why wait for the president to achieve some sort of clarity, which he may never?
Right.
Like, why should Congress wait?
Well, I certainly agree with you that, and I don't want to be misunderstood, that I think Congress has ceded too much power to the executive. And we need to look at many different ways to take that back. If you know, we've done it in the budget. We've done it in many other areas where, you know, the authorized military force, you name it. There are many areas where we have really made a strong executive. And I think we have to, whoever sits in the White House, we have to think about that balance of power. And that's not necessarily just in a Trump administration, but overall, do we have the balance right? And there is a place for Congress that is important because we are elected on a much more community level. And we are held accountable to the voters every 2 years in the House. And that's an important connection. And I think that we have built up a very strong executive that is a dangerous path in some ways. So I want to be clear that I don't think that having an extremely strong executive is a good state. But I think we have to look at it, and not only in terms of what is happening at this moment with the president's latest tweet, but really overall make sure that we have that balance correct.
You know, my habit is to like really get in the weeds with certain certain bills and certain laws. But I should just take a step back here briefly and say, you know, what are your legislative priorities for this session?
Yeah, well, we are working a lot on the opioid crisis, which continues, even though we have some reason for optimism, some good numbers showing that our death rate is going down in Massachusetts, but it's still way too many people and too many parents that I have talked to, too many funerals that people attend for are young people who are dying of overdose. And we are working across the aisle to focus on prevention, to really look at the adolescent, make sure we have the research to know how we can reach the adolescent who has substance use disorder and find the right treatments for them. We're also looking at seniors and Medicare and a lot of the fraud and doctor shopping we've seen in Medicare. We have a bill to require that they have electronic prescriptions. And at the same time, we know the genesis of a lot of this epidemic came right from the doctor's prescription pads.
Exactly.
So we have a bill that would set up a resource that would be state-based for doctors, because research has shown that over half of the doctors say we don't really know how to prescribe and what alternatives for managing pain can be. And it's modeled after a very successful program we have in the Commonwealth for treating postpartum depression. And we think it's a great model for doing this kind of doctor education.
And
most recently, been working on a bill that just had a hearing in front of the Energy and Commerce Committee looking at our workforce and having a student loan repayment program specifically for those who have gone into substance use disorder treatment.
Oh, interesting.
So up to 6 years, we'd pay up to $250,000 in student loans, and that would cover everyone from doctors to recovery coaches.
Okay. So we've just got 2 minutes left here or so, and there's so much we could have talked about. I didn't ask you about gun legislation or anything, but I do want to just kind of wrap up with looking forward to the 2018
yes.
midterms. You're co-chair of the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee's Red to Blue program. Before we get to that, though, I think one of the most interesting races in the country right now is here in Massachusetts in the 7th, because Congressman Capuano has a primary challenger in City Councilor Ayanna Pressley. I'm just wondering what you make of that race.
I'm a fan of them both, personally. I am supporting Mike for his reelection, but I also think that Ayanna's run is good for democracy. And I think that she has every right to run. I think she's a terrific city councilor, and I think that she would make a good member of Congress. But I think Mike has really been someone that we can rely on in the delegation. He's got a great progressive record and vote. And I think his seniority on some key committees is going to be very helpful for the country and here in the Commonwealth.
Okay, so I have to ask you, as a woman representative for Massachusetts, I mean, another thing that Ayanna Pressley has said repeatedly is, yes, right, it's good for democracy. There should be primary challengers. But in addition, she sees it as more than that. She sees it as, you know, you need to bring new ideas, a new fresh perspective, a different voice. I mean, we don't have that many women, first of all, in the delegation,
right.
and zip when it comes to women of color.
That's right.
So, I mean, could those...
Or men.
or men of color. Could those things actually be more important in the long run for representing Massachusetts than the seniority that Congressman Capuano perhaps brings to Washington?
Well, that's why I think it's great that she's running, because I do think that that perspective, that viewpoint is unique to her and is one that in a majority-minority district like the 7th may really resonate with voters. And I think we have to think about that as we go forward. I certainly don't ascribe to the she needs to wait in line theory. I think that it is good to have that debate. And, you know, it's going to be up to the voters to see where it lands. But I also think that nobody has a dispute in this race with Mike's voting record.
Well, Catherine Clark is the congresswoman from Massachusetts' 5th District. I feel like we only just got started. And look, we went for more than 20 minutes here. So come back soon if you could.
I would love to.
I'd love to have you back. Thank you so much for joining us today.
All right. Thank you.
We'll be back. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.